This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. There was a spike in counseling service appointments last academic year at East Carolina University in Greenville, and a major cause of concern is a lack of coping skills regarding the uncertainty of life, like failure and adjusting to new environments. It mirrors a nationwide trend among college-age students, and as Chris Thomas reports, it's only the tip of the iceberg facing millennials.
Some members of East Carolina University's student body are feeling anxious, even before classes begin.
It feels pretty great. It's kind of scary. I've never really done anything like this, especially not having family here. It's a little stressful.
That's Misty, a freshman from Concord, North Carolina. She's studying ecology and evolutionary biology. When we caught up with her, it was her second day on the campus. Move-in week is in full swing at ECU. Parking is hard to come by, and it's hard to turn without seeing an undergraduate's sweaty face or a tense, beleaguered parent.
I'm really looking forward to learning something new. I picked a major I didn't really know a lot in, so I'm excited to learn new things and definitely make new friends.
That anxiety is hardly exclusive to lower classmen. John is a senior and studying finance.
Sometimes when I have a lot of workload in front of me, I get anxious, but most of the time, the way I deal with it is that's when I work the best, when I'm anxious and I'm just really stressed out. I perform the highest, so I don't really mind getting that anxious, but definitely affects people in different ways.
Anxiety is one of the defining attributes of the most recent group of students at the university, Dr. Valerie Kistler-Van Reed said. She's director of ECU's Center for Counseling and Development Services and has been on staff since 1997.
Depression used to be the primary concern that students presented with, and that has been a definite shift. Now the top reason that students come to the Counseling Center is definitely anxiety. We're seeing students feeling much more worried and anxious, definitely presenting with panic attacks. And I think it's just a lot more common to feel worried and anxious and unsettled in our society as a whole.
A primary issue? Resilience, even with universal challenges of everyday life, sometimes called adulting.
What we would normally find as negative experiences that everyone experiences, like things like failing a test or a relationship breakup. So just normal negative experiences.
Counseling services had more than 9,000 appointments during the last academic year, according to data from ECU's Division of Student Affairs. That's a nearly 20% increase from the previous year. The staff at Counseling and Development has more than doubled over the past two decades, and two counselors were added in the past year. According to figures from Dr. Virginia Hardy, Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs, the price tag for fiscal year 2017 is more than $780,000.
It was a gradual uptick, I think, for probably 3 to 5 years. The last couple of years, it's been like wham, or truly, what happened? And so that's what caught our attention.
It's been implied that these new hires are associated with an adulting program at ECU. Dr. Hardy said adulting wasn't in her vocabulary until earlier this month.
I had not heard until I saw it in the media. That was the interesting thing about all of that. Resilience is what we're talking about. It is how do we help our young people transition into college, throughout college, and after college.
A possible element in play is an excessive role parents are playing in their child's affairs, even after they've left for university. Dr. Hardy said students arrive on the campus with co-opted definitions of personal success.
I'm not sure that we're at a place where the individuals can define success for themselves, not what mama and daddy may want or what society may say is the success, but what does success look like for me? Because that success may be completely different than the next person.
It's been given many names, including overparenting. It's become a nationwide trend, not accepting East Carolina University.
And I talked to our parents during orientation about this, and again, appreciating and respecting their roles in what they're wanting for their children and not minimizing that at all. But I think that we need to do a little bit more of allowing them to navigate and to learn how to navigate the life in general.
But there are other factors to consider. The stakes are high for millennials, higher than they've ever been in some cases. A growing $1 trillion student debt crisis looms, joined by nagging labor dilemmas making well-paying jobs scarce, even with a bachelor's degree. Dr. Hardy believes the younger generation, as a whole, has risen to the challenge.
When you think about it, they're very service-oriented. They want change, and they're willing to fight for it, to argue for it, to make change happen.
The recent uptick may even be a positive sign, Dr. Kistler Van Reed said. It may signal reduced stigma surrounding psychological therapy.
I think they're willing to encourage their friends to get help as well. I think that's something that we hear frequently, that they will disclose to others that they have had counseling, they've had counseling in the past, or they know a friend who did and it was helpful. So they are mindful of what's going on with the people around them and encouraging them to get help.
Little is known as to why traffic continues increasing at ECU Counseling Services. The university hopes to find out more as its resiliency project, which kicked off in 2015, continues surveying its student population. Millennials, as a generation, are under immense pressure from a lost past, an ambiguous present, and a potentially bleak future. That, by most standards, is clear. If you want to hear more, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Chris Thomas.
We love our furry companions. For better.
He's such a good boy.
Or worse.
Sadie, why were you eating the Kleenex?
But when it comes to changing your dog's behavior, training tends to focus on making them respond to human commands in order to make them act more human. But a local nonprofit has made it their mission to move people to a new way of thinking about pet training and behavior. Down a long gravel road in Maysville, far from Highway 17, stands Safe Harbor Farm Canine Rescue and Rehabilitation Center. An old church on the 61-acre property has been refurbished as a clinic. There's outbuildings and log cabins surrounding a one-acre pond. This is not your normal animal shelter. Cats, ducks, and chickens are roaming about, and it's quiet. No dogs barking. Unusual for a pet shelter.
Is it deer or dogs back there?
Probably deer.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, when you drove up, I had that little fox. We had lots of wildlife back here.
Lynn Swanson started Safe Harbor Farm back in 2005 as a pet rescue. And it's not just domesticated animals that are drawn to this place.
We have heron, blue heron, green heron, egrets, lots of turtles. I'm always picking up turtles on the side of the road, bringing them here.
In the early days of Safe Harbor Farm, the center cared for 20 to 40 dogs at a time. But now they're down to about a dozen. And that's just fine with Swanson. It frees her up for a new endeavor called the Smile Project. She says the light bulb went off as people took notice of how polite and quiet the dogs up for adoption were.
People started asking us how the heck we did what we did, you know, and that wasn't a question that we could answer in 10 words or less.
In 2013, Safe Harbor Farm brought together pet professionals, veterinarians, trainers, and shelter personnel to provide training in canine communication. There was also a demand to make the information at the conferences available to the average dog owner. This is the beginning of the Smile Project, which Swanson says aims to keep savable dogs out of animal shelters.
A lot of times people give up on their dogs because they just don't have the knowledge that it takes to turn things around. My message to them is, most of the time, it's pretty darn easy.
Swanson believes getting inside the dog's head, understanding their body language and behaviors, will help you train your dog better and result in a happier pet. She demonstrates with Jenny, a white German Shepherd mix.
She's the one who lets us know that somebody's at the door way before any of us know. She's going to come over and say hey.
So we're walking up to the cage right now.
Up to her nice big pen. That's an alert bark. Okay, she's saying, hey, somebody's new.
Swanson opens the gate and Jenny runs up to greet us. She's been at the shelter for about 5 years, and she's here because she was likely hit by a car at some point in her life and now is incontinent.
And when she does a walk around, she'll probably just like a walk away and then come back, just letting you know that she is comfortable with you. That's something that people get wrong a lot of times. They think a dog who walks away is like a person who walks away and doesn't approve. If a dog walks away, they're signaling comfort with you or approval of what you're doing.
I'm standing in the pen right now, and the dog is circling around my feet, sniffing me, but I'm not reaching down and touching him.
Yeah, exactly. When we meet each other for the first time, we look each other in the eyes. We reach out a hand and we're verbal. Hi, how are you? I'm Lynn. But if you have two dogs who haven't met each other yet and they're verbal and reaching out, none of that's good.
She's walked away now.
Yes, so she's signaling total acceptance of you. At this point, there's going to be no more alert barking. You can walk back and forth, make yourself at home, and you're one of the family.
Understanding how a dog thinks and acts, Swanson believes, is a key in helping people address problems with their dogs. She says it goes beyond training a dog basic commands like sit, stay, and roll over.
Dogs are by their nature a nonverbal species. So we go so much farther when we communicate with them in a way that they communicate with each other. And how is that? It's through motion and movement.
And it's also through energy.
If we're talking softly, most dogs understand, oh, okay, I don't have to respond to that. But if you get more excited and your voice turns like this, and then you have all that inflection in your voice, the dogs, look at this. You see how he picks up his head and he's looking at me? Mm-hmm. He's purely responding, not to the words I say, but to the energy behind those words.
In the past, Safe Harbor Farm has provided thousands of spay, neuter, and vaccinations to pets and helped find homes for animals in eastern North Carolina. But Swanson hopes a new focus on the Smile Project will broaden their scope, helping prevent dogs from ending up at animal shelters across the United States and around the world. Last month, her book, Smile, and Other Practical Life Lessons Your Dogs Can Teach You While You're Training Them, was released.
We can't bring everybody to our shelter. We can't train every person. We can't train every dog. So we're putting this out and hoping that it helps a lot of folks.
The book is available at public libraries in North Carolina, Virginia, and New York. 100% of the proceeds from book sales benefit the Smile Project.
Nobody makes a cent but the Smile Project, not even the author. That's me. You know, we just kind of did this because we just wanted to get the information out. And yeah, we're just here to help, and this is the way we're helping.
For more information, go to publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. More and more communities in eastern North Carolina are striving to be bicycle and pedestrian friendly. Building sidewalks or bike paths connects people with commercial areas, promotes healthy lifestyles, and increases aesthetic appeal. The North Carolina Department of Transportation is paving the way to help municipalities develop plans that encourage safe walking and biking. Mac McKee speaks with Planning Program Manager with NCDOT's Bicycle and Pedestrian Division, John Vine Hodge, about the grant initiative.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Bicycle and Pedestrian Grant Initiative? How did it get started and why?
Sure. Bike Pedestrian Planning Grant Initiative, I believe it began back in 2004. And at that time, there was a recognition of, a growing interest in biking and walking. But there was limited specific planning to that. The idea was to create this grant program where you'd fund these bike and or pedestrian plans through a competitive process. And the locals, whoever was awarded, had to provide a matching amount to that. So I think as we see it now, the primary purpose of the plan is really, as I like to describe it, is to provide kind of a framework for how a community can become more bike-friendly, pedestrian-friendly, or both, and really pretty much kind of focusing on enhancing mobility by putting in infrastructure facilities, sidewalks, shared-use paths. It's making it safer for both bicyclists and pedestrians.
Well, Mr. Vinehodge, how many projects has North Carolina funded since the beginning of the initiative?
We are up to 174 plans now, and that would be bike plans, pedestrian plans, and or for communities of 5,000 or less, we allow joint bike-pedestrian plans to occur at the same time. We've hit like the higher population centers, but we've really been able to spread it around the state to hit rural areas as well, so we're pretty happy with our coverage.
Now, speaking of that, when you think of eastern North Carolina, Emerald Isle in particular stands out in their efforts to provide bike and pedestrian paths in the community. Their 11-mile path was created as a way to connect residential areas with commercial centers. In your opinion, do you feel like Emerald Isle serves as a model for other eastern North Carolina towns wanting to develop bike or walking paths?
Having that path in place, which I am familiar with that, is significant and is a good model for other communities. I think as we've done these bike pedestrian plans, we've keep hearing back from communities that they want a separated facility I'm talking about like bicyclists right now, but you have your people that are comfortable riding in the road or in bike lanes and those types of things. But some people won't get on a bicycle unless it's a separated facility. So having this in place is commendable, and it will help encourage more people to use it. One thing I'm aware of is that Emerald Isle has a bicycle and pedestrian advisory committee, and I believe they only have a year-round population of 4,000 or 5,000. So, and I know it swells over the summer months, but a community that size to have a bike pedestrian advisory committee is not that common in the state. Larger communities usually don't. Many of them do not have that as well. So, I think having that in place really shows the support for bike pedestrian in that community and is commendable as well. So,
now, what are some of the other cities and towns in eastern North Carolina where the NCDOT has helped develop bike and pedestrian plans?
We've been able to hit around New Bern, Morehead City area. We have Washington, Beaufort, Kinston, Pine Knoll Shores, Atlantic Beach, Swansboro. Actually, most of those plans were done probably like 5 or more years ago. More recently, Trent Woods, and I see Newport here, and that's actually an ongoing plan they were still working on. So,
some communities here in eastern North Carolina have sidewalks for pedestrians, but cyclists have to ride in the road. Now, why is that?
Some communities have chosen by, I believe, local ordinance or some other regulatory means to permit bicycles on sidewalks, either all sidewalks or perhaps just section of the sidewalk that maybe a sidewalk that's in like a downtown zone where you may have a lot more pedestrian activity. I think we as DOT, this is not something we do not wish to prohibit. Bicycles on sidewalks, we don't wish to prohibit them. It's really not something we typically encourage either.
How many accidents occur in North Carolina, and how those statistics have they changed due to the grant program providing more paths?
Looking at DMV data, and we actually work with the Highway Safety Resource Center out of UNC Chapel Hill, we've really been kind of consistent around 2,500 pedestrian crashes per year, and of those, about 150 to 200 have been fatal. It varies by year. And around 900 to 1,000 bicycle crashes, and about 20 to 25 of those are fatal. Initially, when you look at this, the number has generally remained the same about the number of crashes over the last 10 years. This may seem discouraging saying the same, but I think you also have to think about at the same time that the population of the state has increased considerably over, it's one of the fastest growing states. And you also have more people, I'm seeing them out every day, more and more people walking and biking, particularly in the urban areas. And I think there is this movement, you know, not by everyone, but there's this movement and this desire to be in a more walkable, bikeable locations, and people are responding to that. And you are seeing, you know, more and more people out there. So I think while the crash rates are staying the same, you also have more and more bicycles and pedestrians out there. So maybe the rate is actually going down.
So how many individual plans do you hope to fund this year across North Carolina?
Due to our current funding, it's probably going to be about 10 plans. I know the last 2 years, 2 years ago we had 9, and this past year 10, so I'm assuming somewhere around 10 plans.
Mr. Vinehodge, thanks so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Sure.
And if you'd like more information on the 2017 Bike and Pedestrian Grant Initiative, go to publicradioeast.org.
This summer, homeless shelters and soup kitchens in eastern North Carolina have noticed an uptick in people in need. Whether it's food for children out of school or a place to cool down in air conditioning, nonprofits in Onslow and Craven counties are stretching their resources in a time when donations have dropped. Courtney Thompson has more.
On a normal day in spring or fall, Onslow Community Services serves around 100 people in their soup kitchen. Executive Director Theo McClammy says this summer more than 150 people are filing through their doors every day.
We also have a mobile soup kitchen. We may serve 500 meals through our mobile soup kitchen. That number may increase to over 600.
And it's not just a food service drain. OCS also maintains a homeless shelter now filled to maximum capacity.
Because it's the summer season, and just like in all of our households, the air conditioning system is operating overtime, so there's an uptick in the utilities cost.
The surge of individuals and families needing assistance and the increase in cost to provide services comes at a time when the Jacksonville nonprofit is experiencing a drop in donations.
many regular donors are outside of their regular routine. People are on vacation, recreational activities.
He says they're especially mindful of expenditures during the summer, constantly evaluating how to trim their budget or simply do without. The soup kitchen is accepting non-perishable food donations, but the greatest need right now is maintenance on their food delivery trucks, which provide food for people living in Hubert and Richlands.
You want to be good stewards of the resources that you have so that you don't get to the point where we're having to turn away someone who's homeless, that we're having to turn away someone from the soup kitchen. We're not at that point yet, and we hope not to get to that point.
In New Bern, Religious Community Services also has increased demand.
You can wait up to 45 minutes to be able to be seated.
Executive Director at RCS, Juliet Rogers, says they serve an average of 175 people in their soup kitchen each day, but during the summer it goes up to more than 220.
We are the only active food pantry in Craven Jones and Pamlico County, which runs a soup kitchen, which is operated 365 days of the year.
In addition, RCS has a food pantry and a homeless shelter. As temperatures soar and more people seek refuge at the shelter, resources at RCS are being stretched. One of the sources most affected is their prescription voucher program.
We are the only place that people can come to receive prescription vouchers. And once that money's gone, there is no place that if you're coming out of the hospital that you could actually get help for prescriptions. You know, the hospital will see you, but they won't give you a prescription. So people can come to RCS and get that.
RCS benefits from a North Carolina Community Foundation grant to purchase reclaimed food from area grocery stores. But if things get worse, Rogers says, a support group of local churches and other organizations will step in. The priority, according to Rogers, is feeding the hungry.
We will cut back on amount of prescription drugs that we give or the amount of utility or rent that we give to ensure that we are feeding everyone that comes in and asks for food from us.
For Public Radio East, I'm Courtney Thompson.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Fall is coming up, it's just around the corner, and fall is actually the best time of year to plant trees, shrubs, and perennials in coastal North Carolina. The combination of cooler weather, but the still warm soil, allows plants to grow new roots and become well established through the fall and spring months. So in honor of the upcoming planting season, I want to give you some tips on planting successfully. Today, we're going to talk about the planning that goes in before planting. The first consideration always has to be put the right plant in the right location. Before you drag it home from the garden center and start digging a hole, have you thought about the plant and what it needs? Does the plant require full sun, part sun, or shade? Does it tolerate wet soil or dry? Or is it one of those divas that needs moist, well-drained soil? Who the heck has that? Have you looked at your site and noticed how much sun it gets throughout the day? It's best to track where the shadows lie on your property at different times of the day. 8 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock, noon, 2 p.m., 4 p.m., and so on. Does your location drain quickly after it rains, or is this a site where water can stand for several days? If plants are not adapted to wet locations, standing water for several days can quickly cause root problems and plant failure. It is important to measure your space and look at the mature size of the plant. If you're continually pruning the shrubbery to keep them from growing up past your windows, or pruning a tree to keep its limbs out of the sidewalk, you have the wrong plant in the wrong location. Look for a specimen whose mature size fits the space you have available. It's heartbreaking to watch a tree grow for 4 or 5 years, to suddenly realize that you did not leave enough available space for it and that it will need to be removed. So do that studying before you dig your first hole. Now, before we start digging the hole, let's talk about soil amendment. Any changes that need to be made to the soil should be done prior to planting. You want to work lime and fertilizer, if needed, into the root zone of the plant, and this is hard to do once there's a plant in place. If soil amendment is needed, it is best to amend an entire bed, not just the hole that you're going to put the plant in. And it really is preferable to group plants in beds rather than placing individual plants alone in the landscape. Not only does this make soil amendment easier, it also makes the landscape look more cohesive, and the plants are easier to maintain. You don't have to mow an edge around lots of smaller plantings. Next week, we'll talk about actually digging the hole, planting, and how to care for your plants after planting.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.